Okay, Russian expert here. I want to ask you, before we get into our questions, what the hell is Putin after? you know, does he want to restore the old Soviet Union, destabilize the U.S., destabilize Europe, all of the above? How do we best deal with this guy?
Right, well, I'll just tell you a little story, a little vignette, and I think it will answer the first question, what's he up to. So I'm a Russianist, and at one point he kind of liked me because I was a Russianist. I don't think that's probably still the case, but in any case, once we were talking, and he said, Condi, you know us. Russia has only been great when it's been ruled by great men, like Peter the Great and Alexander the Second. Now, at that point, there's that little voice in your brain that wants to say, and do you mean Vladimir the Great? But of course, you wouldn't say that, because that would be rude, so I didn't. But that's who he thinks he is. He thinks he's reuniting the Russian people in greatness. He's wrapped himself in nationalism, orthodoxy, anti-Westernism. He's avenging the end of the Cold War. He says that it was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century that the Soviet Union collapsed. That's quite something for a country that lost 25 million people in World War II. Mm. And it's too bad if that means you have to take territory from a neighbor like Ukraine or fly bomber runs along the coast of Sweden. I mean, what's Sweden done to the Russians in the last 300 years or so? Or, you know, if you have to threaten American allies. And certainly, if you can weaken Europe, that's a very big, important part of this, and break the transatlantic link. So all of that, I think, is a part of both a kind of vengeful policy and one that seeks to reassert Russian greatness. The problem with reasserting Russian greatness is it is being reasserted the old-fashioned way, military power, domination, because when is the last time you bought a product made in Russia that wasn't from petroleum? So what do they have in the international system? It's their military power and their will, and he has demonstrated that you can play a weak hand pretty well if you have will. Now, how to deal with it? You have to stand up to it. I think that the work that the two of you did in your respective terms as Secretary of Defense to reinforce our NATO allies with rotating forces so that there's a very clear message to Putin, don't go any further. Article 5, an attack upon one, an attack upon all matters. I think increases in the defense budget help. But I think I would personally arm the Ukrainians. I think to raise the cost to the Russians of what they're doing in Ukraine. And by the way, there's a low-level, everyday conflict going on in eastern Ukraine that is keeping it unstable. It's not on your front pages, but it's going on with Russian separatists who are backed by the Russian military. So you've got to stand up to him because he respects strength. Now, let me just say one final thing. There are things we can cooperate with Russians on. Unfortunately, because we didn't act in Syria 4 or 5 years ago, we have no leverage in that conflict. The Russians did act. We can say until we're blue in the face, Assad must go. We can't do anything about it. But if the Russians become convinced, Vladimir Putin is not a sentimental man. If they become convinced that Assad must go, he will go. And I think one of the things that the administration is trying to do, when Rex Tillerson went to Moscow and said, given what the Syrians have done in the use of chemical weapons, you are either complicit or incompetent in what you did with that agreement that you did is to get the Russians to see that maybe they don't want Assad for the long run, because ultimately, a peace in Syria is going to have to come through Moscow. The only other place that we might cooperate is North Korea. We'll get to that. But if a North Korean long-range missile can reach Alaska, it can reach Vladivostok.
Okay.
Leon, can I just add?
Go ahead.
I think Leon and I were reminiscing earlier about first meeting Vladimir Putin in the 1990s. I always say, people say, do you know what's going on in his head? And I always say, just listen to what comes out of his mouth. Because he says exactly what he's thinking. And it is exactly what Condi says. And, you know, in power relations in general, you try to work with another country where you can and where you can make your interests align or overlap, and where you can't, you don't. And with Russia, not only have those areas where we've been able to align our interests narrowed over the time of Vladimir Putin's presidency, but the thing I wanted to say is there's one way in which he defines Russian success, which makes it impossible to align with it, which is as our failure. And if there's somebody who's the essence of their policy is to thwart yours, it's a little hard to build a bridge to that motivation. And that is why we try with North Korea, we try a little bit with Iran, but in Syria, Ukraine, and so forth, the only thing to do is to stand strong. And we're going to need to do that for a time until, it's not going to happen soon, Vladimir Putin passes from the scene, or I consider this unlikely, he changes what is really a fundamental part of his mindset.
Yeah, let me ask you, and it's one of our questions here. Can North Korea be worked with through diplomacy, or are they beyond any reasonable approach? And in discussing that, I think it's worth discussing China and whether or not, our effort to try to convince China to play a role in dealing with North Korea is getting anywhere, or is that a waste of time?
Well, I'll tell you a little story about that. In 1994, I spent about half my time that year planning a strike on the Yongbyon reactor in North Korea in the Defense Department, because we thought they were about to unload the reactor, and we were prepared to do that. And we didn't do that. And later in that decade, we made a diplomatic effort when they halted their program. And I went to Pyongyang, which is a really crazy place to be, particularly if you're in defense background. And so I've seen a lot of turns of this wheel. And there have been, the common denominators, and you see it coming up again today, and people are talking about it, including the president, and I very much understand it. Is looking at it and saying, well, listen, we understand they hate us, right? They're very open, the North Koreans are about that, and the Americans and their people, but they are abjectly dependent upon China. So why is it that China can't turn this around? And doesn't China see the writing on the wall here, which is a growing danger created by this little Disneyland, which is on their very own border and over which they have unique leverage? So the puzzle has always been, why don't the Chinese do more? And here's why I don't think the Chinese do more. They, like the frog in the heating pot of water, don't jump because they fear more either the collapse of North Korea, which they induce if they apply pressure, or a war, which they know we will win. You know that war very well. We planned that for 50 years. We know exactly what we're doing. There's no question that we will destroy the North Korean armed forces and the regime, but it is an intensity of violence, the likes of which the world has not seen in a half a century. I mean, so it's not something easy to get into. And they know that it will end with a unified Korean Peninsula allied with the victorious United States. And they fear that. So they fear collapse, and they fear a circumstance which ends up with us on their border. Those are the reasons why the Chinese haven't jumped. Now, there may be some ways diplomatically that we can address those things, but you also have to come, there's so much attention on China at this moment. Don't forget South Korea and Japan. Because there's not going to be any final solution, diplomatic or any otherwise, without the Republic of Korea. They have to agree, otherwise there'll be a spoiler to it. And there obviously is no war on the Korean Peninsula that doesn't involve the South Korean people in the most elemental and difficult sort of way. And Japan has a history with the North Koreans, and so that's why it ends up being a number of people involved. So because I'm pessimistic about the Chinese, Leon, changing this motivation, even though you can tell them until they're blue in the face that you think that that's the wrong discount rate to be applying to this circumstance, they're doing it anyway. And even if we could line them up, I don't think it's very likely we'll simultaneously line up the South Koreans and the Japanese. I think for the time being, we're deterrence and defense. We've really got to keep our eye on those things. And that's why the missile defenses are important. That's why 28,500 troops on the Korean Peninsula. Mm-hmm. I wish I had a way to get out of that, but deterrence and defense is number one now. I don't mind people continuing to take a run at this diplomatic thing. I'm just giving you my assessment. I'm not optimistic.
What do you think?
I agree, but the reason we need it, we tried to align these in the six-party talks to have Japan, Russia, exactly. China, North Korea, South Korea, and the U.S. at the same table. We made some progress, but that was with his father. And Ash, I agree with you about deterrence and defense, but one thing worries me, and that is I don't think Kim Jong-un is really as stable as his father was. Mm-hmm. And that's
his grandfather. Better.
And one the reason I think the Chinese worry is he's not just potentially slightly unhinged, he's reckless. This is somebody who reached into Malaysia to kill his half-brother who was under Chinese protection. And so I don't know that an American president can tolerate, and I don't mean Donald Trump, I mean an American president, any American president, can tolerate the circumstance in which a slightly unhinged, reckless North Korean leader has a nuclear weapon capable of reaching the United States. And I don't know if that is a 3-year proposition or a 4-year proposition, but it's not a 10-year proposition. Mm-hmm. And so I think the hand's gonna be forced somewhere along the way. And I think what they're probably saying to the Chinese is, you want to avoid that war, then you'd better take the other choice. And, you know, we'll sort out what happens there.
Yeah.
Because I just don't think it's,
I think
we're in equilibrium.
I think that's right. But the answer is the same in both cases.
Yes,
because it
right.
is the forces that I'm calling deterrent forces
right.
That would overthrow the North Korean regime, and defense we're going to have to do. It's important to have them because it doesn't go quickly. And he'll unload some of what he has in the early days of a war, if one were to start. And we need to protect ourselves and our people yeah. and our friends and allies from that and our troops. And so you got to have that ingredient. But I think Condi's right. If you despair, as I do, or I don't consider the diplomatic path likely, we don't have to boil in the pot. But then it's a tall order because you are talking about
substantial. No, but I think Condi's right that if you get to a point where they've got an intercontinental ballistic missile and a miniaturized nuclear weapon that they can put on top of that, somebody's going to have to act.
Yeah. Yeah. The single most dangerous yeah. situation, I think, in the world today.
Let's turn to terrorism and two questions that are related. How safe is the U.S. from a new generation of terrorists, and how can we improve our strengths? This is to you, Dr. Rice. Many young people, including my daughter, who will be graduating from college in 2 weeks, have expressed deep concern for the safety of our country in the wake of increased terrorist attacks on innocent citizens. What positive encouragement and advice can you offer as they go out in the world?
Well, it's the problem that we have now, you know, I actually think we managed to destroy the Al-Qaeda organization that did 9/11. That organization doesn't exist anymore. It's metastasized into some places, and ISIS has metastasized into some places. But the hardest threat really is what people are calling the lone wolf or homegrown threat, because there, you're not in the realm of chasing terrorists out there. You're trying to chase them here, and that has all kinds of civil liberties and other implications that we're all very uncomfortable with. And I think that what we have to do, and my encouragement would be that every day, intelligence agencies and the FBI and others are working together better than they ever had in the past to try and find those threats. It means that we're going to have to look. The long pole in the tent is you're trying to stop an attack. Mm-hmm. So information is the most important thing that you can do. And getting to the place that communities will not allow terrorists to plot and plan without alerting authorities, it's absolutely critical. Getting to the place that we have the resources, you were saying earlier, to vet people who are trying to come into the country. Getting to the place that perhaps we tolerate some invasion of social media, of people who are behaving strangely so that we know what they're plotting and planning. Those are all very difficult choices from the point of view of a privacy and civil liberties concern. But they're also absolutely necessary to protecting the country. And if I could just say one thing about that. You know, people say, how do you balance security and privacy? Well, actually, we balance it across our three branches of government. So the president is always going to be a little bit more oriented toward the security side. If you don't believe it, look at a constitutional lawyer named Barack Obama, who ended up mostly fighting George W. Bush's war on terror. The Congress can step back and make laws, authorize and not authorize the Patriot Act and so forth, and the courts ultimately determine constitutionality. So I think Americans should be comfortable that our privacy is protected. The issue is, as we protect our privacy, how do we also protect our security? It's difficult, but I think internal, homegrown, is the hardest part.
Let me ask you something in responding to that, Ash. With what's going on in Mosul, and we're, I think, you know, maybe a few months away from winning in Mosul, and we're going after Raqqa, is the likelihood of London-type attacks by ISIS growing that much greater?
I think that the destruction of ISIL in Iraq and Syria is necessary, but it's not sufficient. It is necessary because, as I said, the idea has to be shown to be a loser. And so when you, even if you're a homegrown lost soul or sociopath and you go online, you're not going to get frizzed up by the picture of what you see. You're going to see a picture of defeat and a movement tripping off the edge of history. That's the image that needs to be created there. That's necessary, and I think it's a very important step. And you're right, Mosul will fall and Raqqa will fall, I'm confident of it. And I think that's extremely important. That doesn't end there. We still have issues in Libya and Afghanistan, other places in Iraq and Syria. You have the Syrian civil war going on. There's a lot to do. And so I think they contribute to the homegrown, but I just didn't want to associate myself with everything Condi said. A lot of this is going to be a home field. Let me just say something a little bit more long-term, though. There may come a time when this particular form of, I'll call it Islamist, that is, people who claim to be inspired by Islam, as the principal terrorist movement worldwide, not the only one, when that is sufficiently suppressed, and I don't believe that's the end of terrorism, I'm sad to say. I think those of us who have the business, who've been in the business, and our successors who are in the business of protecting our people and providing that most elemental thing, which is the security of our people, are going to have to be preoccupied with terrorism for a very long time. And the reasons of that time have nothing to do with any religion at all or any particular movement. They have to do with the fact that destructive power that used to be only available to large groups of people in nation states is falling into smaller and smaller, in the hands of smaller and smaller groups. And so there are the means there, and there are always going to be people who are aberrant in some manner, and we're going to have to protect the many against the few. And I'm sorry to say that in defense and intelligence and diplomacy and so forth, I'd like to say that this won't be a lasting thing. I think it is possible, though, and necessary to protect our people. And for their institutions, they pay for us, and that's what we're for. We're supposed to provide them protection. So I don't accept that we can't most of the time and that they can't have the experience that they are basically safe. We owe them that. We need to deliver that at home and overseas.
Okay, this month is the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. Do you see any possibility of peace between Israel and the Palestinians? Is the two-state solution dead?
The two-state solution is the only solution, ultimately. And it's the only solution for a democratic, so that there can be a Jewish democratic state of Israel. The Palestinians are going to have to be in a position to self-govern. You know, and the demographics are not on the side of either, because the most radical elements of the Palestinians are the ones that are having lots of children. Hania, who was the Hamas prime minister at one point, had 13 sisters and brothers, and he had 11 kids. And on the Israeli side, it's ultra-Orthodox and settler communities that are multiplying. And so you've got demographics going against you, and you've got a problem. But I'm going to say something that's maybe a bit provocative and a bit counterintuitive. I think the real work has to be done on the Palestinian side. I fully understand that the Israelis build settlements. Look, I used to go there, and they'd always announce some housing settlement just as I was leaving, and it made me mad as a hatter, you know, because I was there trying to bring peace, and they seemed to be trying to embarrass me. So I know how hard it is to deal with the Israelis. But the Israelis are our allies, they're democratic, and they have offered the Palestinians several times deals that they should have taken. The most recent was with Ehud Olmert in November of 2008, when there was a fully articulated deal. The Palestinians were unable to take it, I think because they've not really been truthful with their own people about what a deal is going to look like. 4 million Palestinian refugees are not going to have the right to return to Israel. Not going to happen. And yet they haven't been able to give up on that myth. There's still too many maps that don't show Israel in a Palestinian classroom. Because Israel is an open democratic society, there are Israelis in peace parties as well as Israelis who are hardcore and over. You don't have that range in the Palestinian territories. And so I think we have work to do with the Palestinians for better governance. We trained security forces. We started in the Bush administration training Palestinian security forces using American military, the generals. You continued those programs. So we need to lay the groundwork for the Palestinians, but ultimately the Palestinians are going to need to take a deal. And I, as much as I know that there are barriers on the other side, that's where I think the real work has to be done.
Hmm. All right. I agree with that. Ash, are the DOD and services investing enough in basic research to assure we are staying ahead of our adversaries in the field of cyber and artificial intelligence capability?
I'm not happy with the trajectory there, Leon, but I don't think the raw dollars are the biggest variable there. The truth is that we in the Defense Department spent a tremendous amount of our innovative energy over the last 15 years on counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. I think we did that extremely well. That is, performed extremely well. Whatever you thought about the various campaigns we were waging, they were well done, but they were all absorbing. And I know that when you're in war like that, it is, and your people, your service people are in harm's way every day, that is preoccupying in a very substantial way. During that time, we didn't do everything that I would like us to have done to keep up in technology with respect to what we call high-end potential opponents like China and Russia. And deterrence hinges upon us having, and it being clear that we have the capabilities that can easily counter theirs. And we lost ground over those 15 years in that regard. I think we need to make up some of that ground. And so money isn't the only dimension of it. The other thing I'd say, which is very important to me, and being out here in California is particularly important, is that when I was coming up, I'm a physicist, so when I came up in this business, and the people who were my mentors and my seniors were people who had worked in World War II or the immediate Cold War period, and they taught me that a scientist had some obligation to take an interest in and contribute to the solution of human problems, and especially defense, where my field had made so much of a contribution. So it was kind of bred into me. And I mean, Condi also, I think, we kind of fell into this mission area over time when we were young and have tried to contribute to it ever since. But we need to rebuild those kind of bridges between that which is the greatest source of American strength fundamentally, which is our innovative culture, our technological strength, our risk capital system, and national purpose. And that's another thing that I think we need to work on. So it's not just money, but remember, we're spending $7,200 billion a year, which is more than Google, Apple, and Amazon, more than twice what they spend combined in a given year. So the Defense Department is still the big dog, and we do a lot in cyber and other fields. It's not all a matter of money.
Let me ask you, in looking at the future, Russia obviously has learned a lot from its capability with cyber, mm-hmm. As we saw in the election cycle last year. But they've been using it elsewhere, France, Germany, other places as well. Is the new form of hybrid war going to be the model for the future, where you use cyber, you use false news, and you use these individuals who...
Little green men.
Yeah, little green men. As they did in the Ukraine,
yes.
To basically create instability. You're not winning anything, but you sure as hell are creating instability.
It is the model.
Is that the model?
It is
for the
model, or the Russian model, in Europe especially, and it does create a problem for traditionally minded people between war and peace. Now, I'm of a simple mind, and I think an attack is an attack. But when somebody attacks you with cyber, there are still people who are going to debate whether that's cyber or not. And I think that even as, and Condi mentioned this, we are beefing up our defenses in Europe, and really for the first time in 25 years, drawing up war plans for NATO. We didn't have those for 25 years. We didn't need them. And we're procuring the equipment for that. The way that is likely to unfold, if God forbid it does, is not the way it was during the Cold War, where tanks rolled over the German border. It'll start, at least, in a very different way. And hybrid warfare is the phrase people use, but I think it means we need a new playbook. And a lot of people think when they go back to Russia, not YouTube, but other people say, well, we need to redo what we did during the Cold War. No, we need a new playbook that recognizes that this is the nature of warfare as the Russians understand. They're very good at it.
Yeah. Just on the cyber point, I'd sort of hoped when the 150 or so countries were attacked in that massive attack, China, everybody, that maybe there was a little opening that people would have said, maybe some kind of international conversation about what's permissible here and what isn't. Because when you think about it, the way we survived the nuclear age was mutually assured destruction. An attack upon, if you attack me, I can do the same to you. But we also found that sort of unsatisfying. And after a while, we started to get, with the Russians in particular, the Soviets, rules of the game and inspections and hotlines and ways to mitigate against accident, or because we didn't want to annihilate each other. That attack seemed to me just the sort of tip of the iceberg of what a real annihilation could look like from cyber, because you had, the Russians were apparently extremely hard hit. So I am not a believer that we're going to do much along the international cooperation front in cyber for a while, but it's just because we may not succeed, it's not a reason to try. At some level, we're all vulnerable to these tools, and it might be something that we should try and have discussions.
Connie, let me ask you this. If you were Secretary of State last year and you saw what the Russians were doing to try to interfere with our election process, and let's remember, I guess, the first information came in June, July, August of last year, and you're Secretary of State and you see them doing this, what would you have recommended to the president?
Well, I believe in blowing the whistle, you know? Say it. If you have real evidence, say it. Because I think we're in the worst circumstance now, which is that it's leaking out in dribs and drabs what they did do, what they might not have done, what the effects might have been. I couldn't watch the interview with Vladimir Putin last night. I just couldn't do it. I decided to read it because the smugness and the sense that I've got America all in turmoil, that's what he wants. And while I might have blown the whistle on them, I think I would have said, you know, we know what you're doing. We have evidence that you're doing it. And at a time of our choosing, we will retaliate. But you know what? We're confident in our institutions, we're confident in our electoral processes. Now go away. Because he gets satisfaction out of the sense of disturbing things and the uncertainty that he's creating and the like. And so I think we needed a more confident response, and probably from my point of view, a more public response.
When, you know, we've talked about this, but I don't think it's ever been defined. When is a cyber attack an act of war?
Well, it's an attack. It's an attack when our people are hurt. I say an act of war turned out to be a legal term.
Maybe
an attack is an attack.
Let's assume there's a cyber attack.
If you come in and you do damage to the American people, and just because you do it by cyber, to me, it's incidental that it was cyber. It is an attack upon the United States. I think we should regard it that way in our defense planning. That doesn't mean we're automatically going to retaliate, but it doesn't mean that you declare it not an attack, or you confine yourself to responding to it through cyber. I think somebody who attacks the United States needs to understand that they may be inviting all kinds of responses that draw on our full power. And if they try to exploit our vulnerabilities, as the Putin interview shows he is doing, well, you know, two can play that game. And I think the real consequence of a public confrontation inevitably leads to the fact that people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And the thing he fears most is that the Arab Spring will come to Moscow.
Which, by the way, I think some of his motivation was exactly that. He is an eye for an eye kind of guy.
Yeah.
And in 2012, we called his election fraudulent, which it was. It was Hillary Clinton who called it fraudulent on behalf of the United States. And now he was going to demonstrate that our election was fraudulent, too. Mm. And that's a reason that I think you have to back him off. I will tell my little story about dealing with him, because I think it says, so back in 2007, I was secretary, and we were trying to get the OAS involved in Venezuela. By the way, if you want to watch a real crisis unfolding, Venezuela, which is awful. It's a middle-income country now where people can't find food or medicine. But in any case, the Russians flew unarmed bear bombers down the coast of Latin America to demonstrate solidarity with the Venezuelans, with Hugo Chavez. And I called President Bush and I said, I'm a Russianist. There's something I want to say. And he said, okay. So I went out and I said, the Russians understand, I'm sure, that flying unarmed bear bombers that are older than I am down the coast of Latin America does not change the correlation of forces. Now, correlation of forces is their word. So Bob Gates calls me and says, oh, I'd like to say something too. And he says, but we are prepared to fly search and rescue missions should those bombers crash, given their advanced age. At that point, no more bomber runs. Sometimes you have to call the Russians on the absurdity of what they're doing, and it's sometimes your best defense.
I remember that story.
a good one.
You know, I get this question all the time, so I enjoy asking you guys the same question, which is, you know, considering all of these flashpoints that we talked about and what's happening around the world, what is it that keeps you awake at night?
I'll go first. I get asked it all the time. And I got two things to say about that, Leon. The first is that I wish I could skinny it down, but you mentioned it. We haven't talked about all of them, but terrorism, North Korea, Russia, China, we haven't really talked about that, and Iran. And that's just now. And then we have to worry about tomorrow, too, an uncertain future, because we've never really been. And so I would like to be able to tell you one thing keeps me up. But I used to tell people this as Secretary of Defense, and I think it's very important. I said, but I'm up so that you don't have to be up. And you want to know why you $600 billion a year. We're supposed to protect you, and you're supposed to be able to sleep okay. So I'm supposed to be up, and you're supposed to be sleeping. That's what it's about. That's what an effective defense, with a minimum dollars possible and the minimum loss of life of American service members possible. That's what we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And now you can sleep at night because you're at Harvard again. Yes. All of those places are to worry about. But the single thing I worry most is that America will not have the energy and confidence to be the glue that we've been for 70 years. The systems operator, as someone said, because the international system doesn't operate itself. It is lawless without a country that is willing to defend certain values, defend certain interests. It was never that people did what the United States said we wanted them to do, but they had to take into consideration what we wanted them to do. And that in itself had a kind of salutary effect on peace and security. And I just hope as we go forward, we'll not forget what an extraordinary run this 70 years has been. It's not that there haven't been conflicts. It's not that there haven't been a lot of lost lives, there have. But if you look at the grand history of humankind, this period since of American leadership has been extraordinary from the point of view of prosperity and peace, particularly among the great powers. And I just hope we're going to remain confident enough to continue to be that glue, because without us, it's going to be a very ugly world for our interests and for our values.
Well, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, obviously a lot of challenges that we're facing in the world, and a lot of concerns about how we face those challenges. But I remain supremely confident about the ability of the United States to survive, not because of Washington alone. I'm more convinced that the resilience and common sense and spirit of the American people and your dedication to doing what's right is what will drive our democracy and what will drive our future. So thank you for coming, and thank you for participating.
Thank you.